Hi, everybody. My name's Don Norman, and I'm an alcoholic. And, you know, just before I was getting ready to do this, I thought, well, I got to blow my nose. No, I have to go to the bathroom. Is my nose itching? I wonder how my hair looks in the back. Kay and Pat are my big sisters. You know, they got sober before I did, so I got to hear everything from them first. Thank Dan for asking me and Don for taking care of me and making sure this was done, and I appreciate it a lot. I went to the lobby. I'll tell you about a little bit about Orange County, you guys. I went to the lobby to check in. I told, hi, lady, and she said, hello, and she sat back, and then she said, I said, I'm here. My name's Don Norman, and blah, 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 and she couldn't find it. She was just looking at it. Finally, she said, normal. I said, no, Norman, and she said, do you have ID? I said, yes, and she said, do you have a credit card? I said, yes. And I said, but I don't want you to charge it. She said, oh, yeah, I'm going to charge it. I said, well, then I can't give it to you. And so she wouldn't do anything and anything. She didn't believe me. I said, the committee, blah, blah. And so I just sat down and called Don. And he rushed over with the everything and took care of it. And I got my key and looked at the lady and said, phew. You know, I don't know exactly when I spoke at Miracles Happen Before, but it's been a long time. And it was down in, I think it was in San Clemente by Avenida Pico, and it was, you went up a hill. So I don't know if any of you all were there, but I remember one of the stories I told, and it was important to me at the time. And, well, I'll just tell you what it was. I was up in San Francisco probably in 83 or 87, something like that. And this guy was up there, and he had these cute shoes on. They were really nice. And so I liked him a lot. So I said, where'd you get those shoes? He said, over at Macy's over there. And so as soon as the break time came, I dashed over to Macy's, you know, and everything. And believe me, I didn't have a lot of money, but I did have a credit card. And so I go to Macy's and I find the shoes and everything, and so I buy the shoes because they were $99. Now, to me, that was a lot of money. That was a lot of money, but I wanted those shoes so bad, you know? So I got them, and I get home, and I get the bill from Macy's, and the shoes were $299. Now, you can imagine my consternation, you know? About these shoes. And so I thought, oh, Lord have mercy. Well, I'm going to have to wear those shoes forever. Here they are. I'll probably be buried in those shoes. Never paid nothing like that. That's ridiculous, you know. Anyway, I'm from L.A. I was born in L.A. I was born in Silver Lake Echo Park, in case anybody knows that area, anything. It was a very mixed area. It's quite integrated, and everybody got along pretty good. There was not a lot of conflict between ethnic groups and races. We all went to school together, so we were pretty cool. And we didn't know that people not in our area were living any different. We thought everybody lived the same way. And so I was selected to represent Los Angeles frequently as a child growing up. I was like, you know, pretty smart, and, you know, I had a nice personality, and so they figured, let this nice little Negro boy represent us, you know. And so I represented at Los Angeles at so many things, mainly the White House. I went to the White House, I believe. What was that man's name? Eisenhower. Eisenhower was the president, and then I went to the Senate, the Congress. I remember the best thing was the Supreme Court, because it was so, so formal and deep. You know, it was really deep. You know, you go in there, and it's purple drapes, and they're all, it's something, you know, and I was very impressed with them, you know. And, you know, but I was one of those activists, too. I was fighting for our rights. I was marching like when I was 7 for, you know, them to take care of us. They wouldn't let us into Bimini Baths. You know, that Bimini Baths was this bathhouse, not a bathhouse, you guys. This, it was swimming pools and things. But they wouldn't let black kids in, or I guess black people. But so we were marching there and everything. And so finally, I think I was 13, that they decided that they would let us in. But they only picked two kids in the whole school. Now, I was one of them, and Joanne Hassan was the other one. And both of us were picked. Now, we know why we were picked. We were light, and we weren't dark. So we got picked first, you know. And we had to do that a lot. Then there came to the time when it was gay bars. And the police in Los Angeles were dreadful. I can't tell you how mean they were. They were meaner than anybody you ever seen. They were like Nazis, you know, that's what they were really like. So they were a problem to us too, you know. So we had to fight that for many years. Remember, we said we were gonna be gay no matter what. We're just gonna be gay later for them. And but anyway, how this all started was I was born. And, you know, I was born on December the 11th, 1935. And it just happens that Bill Wilson was sober on December the 11th, 1934. So ever since then, I found that out. I thought, that's really significant, honey. You know. And anyway, I was born at home. It was in the Depression. And so, you know, people weren't just born in hospitals and things like that. People just made it the best way you could. And I think at the time that my mother told me, my grandmother was there, my Aunt Viola, who I shall love forever, my Aunt Mary, they were all there with her. She said it was the best birth she ever had. It was a sunshiny day and everything. And she remembered. And the doctor who came, I guess it was like somebody comes after the birth to check, and the doctor was a woman and everything. So all these women were there when I was born. Yay! You know? And so, you know, and I grew up, you know, just attached to my cousins. I had about, you know, a lot of cousins. My mother had 11 brothers and sisters, and my daddy had 11 brothers and sisters. So you can imagine the cousins I had. You know, I had aunts and uncles, and we all went to the same church, and I felt well protected. And I'll tell you all a secret. In my family, if you are a lesbian or a queen, they don't care. They don't even care. You're just like somebody else in the family. You don't get away with nothing. You get your ass whipped too, just like everybody else. You know? So I didn't grow up with a lot of conflict about that, you know? Anyway, so as I'm growing up, my mother and father were, the whole family was strict. We were Baptists. And not Southern Baptists, a different type of Baptist as far as I'm concerned, because I never, ever heard the preachers say anything about homosexuals. Not once did I ever hear him say, you know how they do Leviticus and you, I never heard that shit. So, you know, so I didn't have that kind of relationship at church. Church was fun. I sang in the choir, I was an usher, everything. So I had a good time in church, but they didn't allow us to do a lot of things. They were strict. They were pretty strict. And so, and also, by the way, many of you, there's some people in here that remember, but back in the day, people could hit you. Your parents could hit you. It was not even considered abuse. It was just considered, yeah, you better straighten up, you know. And my mother would say things to me that would shake you to the ground. You know, I'll be all over you like white on rice and everything. Then don't tell, oh, Lord, don't let her tell you I'm going to whip all the black off of you. And they would slap you. You know, they would slap you. I don't know if you all have been slapped at the kitchen table for whatever, you know, you did. You never know what it was you did. You just find a fork and tooth across the room, you know. I'll slap you into next week. Yeah. So you're kind of nervous, you know. And you're always on edge, you know. And so I was pretty much on edge rocking everything. But there were these other kids in the neighborhood that didn't go to church. And they looked like they were okay. You know, they were out sunshine and playing in the alley and playing kickball and stuff. And so they looked like they had a lot of fun. And so I'm trying to figure out, as soon as I get big enough, I'm going to do just what I want to do. And nobody's not going to tell me nothing. So it just took a while for me to get taller than my mother. I'm taller than her now. then I got taller than my daddy. Ta-da-da. So it wasn't no more ass whippings no more. You know, that was out, you know. So they weren't, but they couldn't tell me what to do. And I'm getting loose by this time. I'm getting pretty loose and have a lot to say and, you know, smart alecky and everything. So at any rate, those kids looked like they were having fun. And they would sip in the alley. You know, they have a bottle of this or a bottle of that. And they'd be out there tipping it up and everything. And I'd see them and think, shoot, that looks cool to me. And so I joined them and have a little sip. But they wouldn't give me enough. You know, it's not enough when you're getting a sip. And I wanted a whole bottle. And so I got me a whole bottle and went to the show one Halloween with my cousins. And Frankenstein and the Wolfman were meeting Dracula. And so I go down there with my fifth, a fifth of wine. I had port wine. I had my whole fifth under my peacoat because I could steal with the peacoat. And I kill it. I kill the Rocco, going to the show to see Frankenstein. And the next thing I know, Doreen is saying, come on, Donald, let's go home. And I said, Doreen, when's the show going to start? And she said, Donald, you saw it. You were sitting right there. It's over. And I thought, I'm not telling nobody nothing about this, you know. And I kept that secret forever, you know. I didn't tell anybody, but that was really strange to me at that time. But at any rate, I liked that drinking thing. And so I started drinking whenever I could. I liked it a lot. We had to get out of high school, and they had told us that if we drank at the graduation, if anything, they smell alcohol or anything else like that, we won't graduate. So all of us had a whiskey bottle and everything stashed under our robes ready, you know. And so as soon as we graduated, we got tore up again. All the class, we all got tore up without me having fun. The next thing you know, I went to City College. I don't even know why I went there, but I went. And I'm in City College, and I'm not doing really well because I won't go to class. You know, I got hangovers, and there was a joint across the street called George's, and we played cards. They'd boo-boo and smoke cigarettes and shit. And so, anyway, there was this guy. I love telling it to gay groups. I can't do this in straight groups. I just have to say there was this guy. But there was this guy who was so fine. Ooh, honey, I'd have done his daddy. Ooh. So he said to me one day, hey, Don. I said, yes. And he said, why don't we join the Air Force as buddies? And I thought he said, let's get married. So there I am, hungover. I'll never forget the day. I'm hungover down at the Patriotic Hall on Figueroa Hill, swearing to protect the country and everything, you know, woo-woo-woo. And it's hot and everything. And then they lug us into these buses and drive us to Parks Air Force Base up by Oakland. And so we're there, and then you get there and they start yelling at you. They yell at you in the morning. They wake you up at 4 o'clock to yell at you, and they're very concerned about the floors. They're just, the floors are their biggest concern besides your shoes. The floors were not clean, and you had to clean them frequently. And they're stupid. The floors aren't dirty. I can see they're not dirty. Shit, I scrubbed floors before, you know. So, and then they wanted me to shine shoes, and I was offended. I said, I'm not. No. So I wouldn't shine shoes, but I figured out if you got Vaseline and put on it, made them shine. So that was good enough for me. But the problem was, in the Air Force, we met these kids. All of us were from California. We were all from California. And we met these kids from other places. They're marching, too. And I guess, I don't know where they were from. I just figured they were from some other states, you know, Idaho or Montana or something. I don't know where they were from. But they would call us names. And they would say things about nothing in California but fruits and nuts, you know. And we had never heard that, you know. Where they got that from? There's more than that. We have a beach, you know. So we're all innocent about their prejudice. We don't know what's wrong with, but they made a mistake, and they would say ethnic slurs, just bloop, right out of their mouth like they were in, you know, could do that. But they can't do that because then I would beat them up. And so, by the way, I have to tell you, I was kind of raised by lesbians, so I was kind of like a tomboy anyway, so I could fight. So they would say things like bloop, bloop, and I would just beat them the ass up. And then sit back and put my hand on my hip. Go tell your mother who whipped you now, honey. But the officers said that I couldn't do that. They said, you can't just beat me. They had me up before some stupid board or something. I don't even know what it was. Article 15, you're in punishment. And you go before them and they tell you what you did wrong. And those other people weren't standing there with me. So I didn't think I did anything wrong. And so they said I couldn't do it anymore. I said, well, I'm going to do it if they say it again. So they just let me go. They said, you can have a stripe. And so I didn't get a stripe. Like I cared. I didn't care if I had a stripe or not. I was not happy with the whole thing as it was. And so, but they decided that they would send me, whatever the needs of the Air Force were came first. And you pick what you wanted to do. You get to pick what you want to do. And you know what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a clerk or entertainment or something like that. You know, something easy. And they said, oh, the needs of the Air Force come first. You are going to be a policeman. I said, a policeman? I'm from L.A. I hate the police, you know? I really didn't like the police. In case anybody here is a policeman, though, I'll tell you now, I love the police now. I love them. I think they're wonderful. If they drive by, I say, get those criminals. That's right. Let me help you. There they are. But at the time, I didn't like policemen. I didn't want to be one, but they trained us in all this stuff in air-based defense and jujitsu and armed blah, 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 and everything, shooting weapons and all this stuff. Well, the only thing about that was that these kids that would say these ethnic slurs would say them at certain times, but it sort of faded out after a while. One guy did it. He actually called me Black Sambo in a line marching. And I thought, oh, no, hunty. And I leaped out of line and just beat him down, you know. And then I got back in line and said, forward march. And but the guys that were in charge of us didn't say nothing that time. And I figured out why. We had guns. And so they... I guess they think he might shoot us. And so at any rate, I get shipped up to Alaska by accident, you know, and I'm from down here, you know, just the rain, you know, like last night was serious to me, you know. And so it rained hard. I mean, I'd never seen rain that hard. You know, hard rain, just pour down rain. I'm like, ooh-wee, we're going to wash away. They said, that's nothing. Wait till you see. It's going to snow in a minute. And I said, really? They said, yes, I'd never seen snow in my life. You know, maybe I might have seen it on the mountains, but that didn't impress me. I'm not sure what that was. But at any rate, the snow started. And it started one day, and I'm thinking, it's very beautiful. The first time it snowed, it's all white and everything, and I'm thinking of Bing Crosby and White Christmas and everything, la, 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 and everything, but it doesn't stop. It just keeps snowing. It snows, and then it blows around, and then blizzards come, and ice is everywhere, and you try to walk, and it's slush and slippery, and you know, I'm going to the Airman's Club to drink. They let you drink as much as you could hold up there. They don't even care. And so I'm drinking, but try to walk in that slushy ice stuff is hard. You know, it's worse than walking in high heels, you know. Anyway, it was rough. And so let me tell you about what they were doing one day, what they did. We all lived in a barrack. All the police guys lived in the barrack, all that police. And everybody's drinking, and we're all, you know. And so two dudes were out in the hallway, and everybody said, they're going to play Quick Draw and McGraw, you know. Bam, bam, and they shot each other accidentally. And so they took our bullets. They said, you can't have no bullets. And they put you out on duty, and you're out on duty on this airfield with these rusty old jets. I mean, rusty jets. You can see they're old. There's nobody's flying them. They haven't flown in years. And so you're out there, and they tell you, this is actually what they tell you. They tell you, you have to guard these airplanes because the Russians will come over here and sabotage them. You're guarding them from the Russians sabotaging them. And you stand out there with this rifle, and the snow's beating in you and everything, and blizzards are going, and I'm sitting there thinking, ain't no Russian in their right mind coming over here to just bomb these things. Shit. So I'd go to sleep, you know. You're not supposed to go to sleep on duty. And I didn't care either. Well, I didn't care what they thought. And then they put me in charge of Alaskan Air Command. It was this big building. And you sit at a desk, and people go by, and they try to trick you. They're supposed to, you have a pass, you know, and you're supposed to see their pass. And I just sit there and chill and be loaded. And I didn't care what they had by, go by, you know what I mean? And I had this stupid guy that was from, he was from Minnesota, I think. I'm not sure where he's from. He has blonde hair, tall, skinny boy. And he was one of those gung-ho policemen, you know, those gung-ho people. And the flag would be going up. You can't even see the flag in the snow. And I'd be crunched over. He'd be all standing. I said, they're not even supposed to put the flag up in this kind of weather. I know. And we'd ride around in this Jeep to arrest airmen, you know, doing shit. And I would think, I'm not arresting nobody. I tell you, even if he catch somebody, it has to take two of you to make the arrest. I wouldn't do it. I said, these people are in this blizzard-filled country with ice all around us, so they can't do shit. You know, let them go if they're drunk, you know? And so anyway, they kicked me out. They said, you're too homosexual for us. With guns at my head, they marched me off like I cared. I was so happy to be gone from that place. Anyway, I get back to L.A., and I remember coming up Temple Street and seeing Rhoda, hey, Rhoda, and everything. And then we got to smoking weed. And you know how it is when you first start smoking weed, you know, your eyelashes get long and glittery, you know, everything's ha, 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 you know. And then we started taking bennies, and, you know, I don't know if you're bennies, but they're speed. They were a form of speed in those days. You swallowed them, and you'd be checked up, you know, and everything. You'd run around drinking and taking bennies, and then you'd be up too long, and they'd give you Red Devils. Take these Red Devils, knock your ass out, you know. And so then I'm taking Red Devils and bennies and smoking weed and drinking and running to the gay bars. Now, you know what the gay bars were back in those days? They were like heaven. They would be packed, just packed. They'd all be pulling on you. You know how they pull on you and everything? Leave me alone. Don't touch me. Yeah. It was fun, though. So I started running to the gay bars and doing all that stuff, and I got a job at the county hospital. It was my first grown-up job. I'd been working since I was little, but that was my first grown-up job. And so I'm working in the county hospital in the dispatch office, where all the pills from America came through this office for the doctors. And yeah, you laugh, ah, ha, ha. I'm looking at these things coming. There are boxes. I mean, hundreds of boxes. I'm not kidding you. Of everything, you know. I say, do you suffer from depression and anxiety? Yeah, I have that. You know. Do you have narcolepsy? Yeah, I have narcolepsy. Yeah. So I'm taking all these pills and loaded, running around the hospital with my tight booty buster pants on and being cute and everything. And it was fun, you know. Except I was getting hooked, you know, and somehow or another, running around, I don't know exactly when it was, but I met this other guy from San Francisco. And back in the day, people in San Francisco were luscious. They were really drunks. That's where they drank. We took more pills and smoked weed and drank down here, but they just drank. And so we thought they should take pills too. And so, and maybe smoke a little weed, you know, and so we turned them on, you know, and I met this guy up there. And we, back in the 60s, it wasn't important to have a relationship. We weren't even thinking about that. It was just do it. You know, that was kind of like what it was. What was that? Drop out and just do it. That we were all using drugs. The Griffith Park used to be full of about 5,000 of us up there. Just tore up. but Red Mountain wine. And the girls had all their titties out, you know. And it was a mess. We were just wild in those days, you know. And up in San Francisco, they had Hippie Hill. And that was another wild thing. So that's kind of how we lived, just loaded all the time. So Russell asked me one day, he said, I think he was in L.A. He said, can you get some heroin? I said, yeah, I can get some heroin. You know, I have to be hip to everything. Yes, of course I can. I don't even know nothing. But I went up and asked this guy named Boxer up at the corner. And he said, yeah, I'll get you some. Don't worry. And so he gave me some three caps of heroin. And me and Russell went, and we shot that heroin. And I thought, I'm going to shoot this shit the rest of my life. You know? So now you see what I'm doing. I'm getting hooked on heroin, taking pills, running the street. And, of course, the police are chasing us constantly, you know. And you get captured. And they capture you in Venice. And then they take you to jail. And I finally moved to Venice because it was a lot. Your chances were better down there because there was more people getting loaded. So, you know, if it's 500 people getting loaded, your chances go 1 in 500, you know. Or some. So at any rate. That's what happened. And so I'm beginning to do that. And back in the 60s, and they said the kids in L.A. were too loaded. They should start these programs. And so they started different programs, drug programs and things. They started the free clinic was on Fairfax. And we all went there. And we tried. They were going to help us out. But, you know, they weren't much of anything. If you sat there for an hour, the doctor would give you some number 4 codeine and some Nimbutol. So you'd sit for that, naturally. And they started another program at the Metropolitan State Hospital, and I went to that one. It was a family drug program. It was rough. It was really a hard program, a lot of yelling, a lot of stuff. But, you know, I was armed with all this information. I had been clean, you know, for 22 months, and I had been the senior coordinator of the place. And I came home, and before the sun went down, I was drunk. So I thought, man, shit. So I just decided that I would not use dope anymore. I'm just going to drink. That's what it is. And so I just started drinking Thunderbird wine. And so that's what the last few months of my getting loaded was just Thunderbird wine. It was probably longer than that because I'd been drinking Old English and Red Mountain. I would drink, tell you the truth, I would drink anything. Anything I could get, I would drink it. And so there I am having convulsions. I'd have alcoholic convulsions and just beat my head and bust my head and bite my tongue. And a lot of blood was shed. I remember some guy knocked me in the eye for some reason with the pistol. And I remember this other girl, we were good friends. I mean, this girl, and she was shooting at me one day and running down the hall. I was Wonder Woman, you know. And she was my friend. I don't know what happened, but those kind of things were happening. My best friend and I, we were loaded one day, and I don't know what it was, but he stabbed me in the lung, and then I couldn't figure out why, but I had hit him in the head with a hammer, you know? So that's kind of my life had come to. I'm in the hospital having convulsions, and life has got jibbity-jibbity, but the thing of it is, my mother and father being Christians, they always felt it was their duty to take care of their children, you know, no matter how trifling they are, you know. And so my mother and father always let me come. I'd promise them I'm going to straighten up, mother. I'm doing my daddy. I could convince one or the other one. And they'd say, okay, Donald. And then I'd steal their TV or something, you know. And, you know, disrespectful, and I dragged tramps in the house, you know, and they didn't, you know, they saw this, and, you know, and the kids were getting bigger now, and they were looking at their Uncle Donald, and I'm a big disgrace. And anyway, one day, they moved. My mother and father packed up everything and sold the building and moved away out to the Inland Empire, and they didn't tell me where they went. So now, you know what I am. I'm one of those floaters, you know, and you just kind of make it. And I guess I was homeless because I didn't have a home. But you know, you could find places, you could sleep on people's patios, and, you know, you could find flophouse hotels that you could stay in. I stayed in the flophouse hotels down, I moved down to downtown L.A., and people call it Skid Row, but we just call it downtown, and so I was living in the, some of those hotels down there, I can't even remember the name of them now, but they were flophouse hotels, you know, most skanky things, and that I felt it was okay, and I'm running around there, and me and my friend, we'd have these bottles of, we'd steal a bottle of whiskey from Thrifties, you know, and they came in a jug, and if you could clip one of those, baby, you were good. You were good for a couple of days, you know, and so me and Miss Ron would be drunk and everything, and I ain't gonna tell you that story. I ain't just not gonna tell it. The last time I spoke at Miracles Happen, I told this dreadful, drastic story. If you wanna know it, ask me later. But it was pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization at death. I was naked, and that was it. And and it was sad. It was really sad. And the only thing I could do when something like that happened, have another drink. That's it. I couldn't quit drinking. I wanted to quit. I was hurting inside. I didn't eat very much. Downtown, there was a chicken place that sold chicken wings for 75 cents, and a bottle of Thunderbird was 79 cents. So it was always a decision on whether you want to eat. At least I'd have chicken wings once a week. And I figured that the Thunderbird was grapes, and so that was my nourishment. Now you guys know Thunderbird has never touched a grape in his life, you know. It was some chemical that was poison, you know, but we liked it, hey, you know. And so at any rate, I'm down there at the flop house just trying to hang and, you know, wishing I could stop, and I don't know what to do. And so that you just pursue this, you just have to pursue it all the way to the end, you know. It says something about that, and then we have to press on all the way to the end, you know. And so there I was, and we have a picnic in my family every year. And this year, I decided I'd go to the picnic. Somehow I'd get there. And I don't know how I got there. I really don't know how I got there. But I do know that when I got there, I saw a bottle of wine across the way and on somebody's table. Each one have a table. And I went to that table and got that bottle of wine, cold up, and killed it. I killed that bottle. All right. And I'm ready now. And somebody had a bowl joint, and I remember smoking a little bit of that, and I remember falling down in holes. You know, there weren't no holes, but I was falling in them. And so they said the prayer. All my uncles and aunts, everybody, cousins, were saying the prayer, and I remember holding hands, hot sun, making noise, you know, because when you're drunk, you know, you think you're cute. And so I had a lot to say, and I remember my cousin Jackie, she looked at me and told me, you better shut up. And so I shut up for a minute. And they said the prayer, and then the music started. And we had a theme song that year by the Sister Sledge called We Are Family. Now, when I'm drunk, I'm cute. I think I'm the cutest thing you ever seen. And I think they should see me dance, too. So the music's going. I'm up on the thing saying, we a family, and I took my clothes off and got naked, and so I remember my father said, get your uncle out of here, get him, and I was hurt. You can imagine, you know, we're always hurt, over feelings, everything, and so they got me out of there, and I always thought it was my nephew that got me, but it was really my niece, but she's a lesbian, and she had a sex, so I said that didn't matter. So we got where we were going. She dropped me off at the Flophouse Hotels, and she told me later she did it, and I told her, okay. So there I was, but the family decided to do a prayer band, and it's something they do, like they call each other up on the phone, and they say, let us pray for so-and-so. So they got on the phone and said, let them pray for Donald, because at one time he had some sense. So they prayed, and I don't know they're praying. I'm still trying to get some more to drink. You know, I'm trying to see if I can get something. Now, my nephew had come down to stick by me because they assigned him to me, Leon, and he was supposed to be watching Uncle Donald. So I guess so I wouldn't jump off the bridge or something. I don't know. But at any rate, he tells me something else happened. on that morning, but I didn't know it. I don't remember that. All I can remember is that something told me to go and call somebody to help me. So I go to the Yellow Pages, and I'm looking up alcohol, and I said, let's make sure it's alcohol, not drugs, because, you know, they didn't mention it, anything. So I find this place on Fifth Street, and I picked 5 because my brain was fried. And I could remember 5 because it's between 4 and 6, you know. So I picked that and tore it out the thing, and then I had no money. So I had to mooch a dime from somebody and went to the phone booth. That's a thing that's like this phone. It has a phone inside of it. I put my little dime in the thing and called up and got this lady on the phone. And I told her, lady, if she could help me. And she said, if you can get down here, we may be able to help you. I said, okay. And she told me where to come. And I couldn't get there because I couldn't walk. And the buses were on strike in L.A. in 1979. So there was this guy that I knew, and he was over there eating. And I said, asked him, said, Sara, you could give me a ride when you get through with that down to Fifth Street? And he said, yeah, as soon as he finished his pupusa. And so he was eating his pupusa, and I'm standing there shaking. I'd been shaking for a long time, and I know I'm going to have a convulsion because I always had them. And so he loads me in the car, drops me down there on Fifth and Crocker, and I shuffle on in. And as I get in, there's these dusty couches and people sitting around, you know, and I sit down, and pretty soon a lady comes out. Her name is Margie Bates, and Margie came out and said, come here. And I went with her, and she sat me down in a chair. All I can remember is I was sitting in the chair, and she said, are you serious about doing something about this problem? And I told her, yes, lady, I'm serious. And she said, well, do you have a gay problem? I thought, oh, God, she didn't ask me that. Oh, shoot. And I said, lady, I'm gay, but that's not the problem. I said, it's this wine that's killing me. And she said she knew it. I thought, she knows that I'm dying? She said, the reason I tell you that is a place in Hollywood that I heard about that helps people like you. Now, this is how miraculous it was. This is a straight woman, downtown L.A., didn't go to Hollywood ever, but she had heard through the grapevine that there was a gay recovery house up in Hollywood. She, in turn, told me to ask to go there. She had never been there, never heard nothing about it, just knew this was there this same day. And so I get and told her, thank you, lady. And she gave me a towel and some Bugler tobacco and a bunk, you know, with those army bunk thing, and a TV that was flickering, you know, it didn't work good. And the door over there was winos outside clinking bottles. I could see them clinking bottles. Hey, you know, winos always give you a taste. And so, but I didn't go over there. I stayed right there. My nephew came in and said, Uncle Donald, I found a place we could go. I told him, no, I'm going to stay here, nephew. And he tells me what I look like at the time. I don't feel like I look like that, but possibly I did. And anyway, I know my niece told me that I was grayish green, and I looked bad. And I was, you know, it's been years of mess, you know. And so I get in line to be dispatched out, and I'm with all these wounded warriors. I remember that hot room. People had black eyes and scars on them. We were all standing up there waiting to be dispatched out. I get up to this black guy, big, fat black man, and he said, where you want to go? And I said, I couldn't remember the name of the band. I said, the Gay Recovery House. And he acted as if I had slapped him, you know. And I knew this is, well, he looked horrible anyway. I don't know what he was afraid of. I sure didn't want him. But, you know, why is it all the more ugly men think we want them? I know the women know what that's like. I think, oh, they don't want your tired ass. Anyway. At any rate, this lady moved him out of the way, swooped around him, and said, I'll help him. And she had red curly hair, and her name was, what? Sally. Sally. And Sally said, I'll help him. And she did. She wheeled me around and moved me into another area, like, and she got on the phone, and she called up this place, And she's talking to him on the phone, and I'm sitting there shaking like a leaf. I felt like a piece of caca. You can imagine, I felt like a piece of caca. I don't think nobody should have anything much to do with me. I'm really ashamed and everything, you know. And she hung up and said, they're going to take you. We'll make arrangements to get you a ride out there and blah, blah, blah. You go eat some food. And I couldn't eat any food. My stomach just would not hold food at the time. I shared, gave it to other people. And finally, this guy gave me a ride. He didn't know how to drive good. He didn't know where he was going. And I'm in the car shaking like a leaf, going down Fountain, trying to find this place. And we get to this school, LeConte Junior High School, and you can't go any farther, and that happens to be Van Ness Street. And he turned, and there was a place. He put me out, and I went walking up the walk by myself, just marking up the walk. My clickers, what they call them, flip-flops, had broken completely. They were no longer usable. I had fastened a safety pin in them, but they just wouldn't work. So I'm going up the walk, broken clickers, and get inside, and this guy's in there, and he gave me a pack of Terrigen cigarettes, TaylorMade's, first time I'd had some in a long time. And he looked at me, and I looked at the floor, and he asked me, have you ever heard of alcohol? No, what do you know about Alcoholics Anonymous? I said, nothing. I was 43 years old in L.A., and I had never heard of AA in my life. So he left the room. And when he left the room, I figured I had messed up. You should have lied. You should have said you knew something about it, you know. But at any rate, he came back in the room, and he said, what are you willing to do, Don? And I said, on August the 29th, 1979, anything. I was beaten badly. Alcohol had whipped my natural ass. I was tired and worn out. And when he said, we're going to take you in here, I said, okay. And they put me in a bed, and he said, we read this book around here, and it's down in the library down there, and we read this book. And it was, I'm not kidding you, it was like a command to my brain at the time. We read this book. It's downstairs in the library. I went upstairs, got my bed, came back downstairs, and got the big book out of the bookcase and went outside on the front porch and read her. Baby, there's nothing in my life that has been as important that I have read. There's no piece of literature in the world that has meant more to me than the big book. There's nothing. I'm reading this book, and it tells about this guy first. You know, Bill Wilson is telling about him. He's silly. You know, this, oh, no, ooh, look at, oh, he is an asshole. You know, you know. And so I see that, and then it goes to haunt you. So can you imagine when you read there is a solution? You are mad. Your brain is gone. You are fried, and you don't know if there's any way back. And it tells you there is a solution. You say, oh, thank you, Jesus. You know, man, it goes on. It says, we're going to talk about God here. I had nothing wrong with it. I'm one of those people. I had nothing wrong with it. By the way, my concept of God has broadened since that day. But at that day, I believed wholeheartedly in God, and I knew that somehow or another he could help me. You know, and so then it goes on to say just how he helps you, that you're not going to just get to do this. You're going to have to do this and this and this. And then you go read more about alcoholism. Was a little bit confusing because I'm not sure what they're trying to say about this peculiar thing that happens, you know, about this man with the milk and, you know, all that stuff. So I'm not quite sure what they mean, but I realize that they're trying to say something, you know. And I said, they're trying to say something. And then it gets to the jaywalker. It tells about the jaywalker, and this is a complete zip damn fool, you know, and he's running out in the street, and he promised everybody, I'm going to straighten up, I promise you, his wife is ready to leave you. As soon as everybody, he runs out again, they put him in the hospital, he's got a broken back, and he runs out again as soon as he gets back. I said, yeah, buddy, yeah, I understand that. So I got that part, that we are assholes, but I didn't really get it until chapter 5. Chapter 4 was okay. You know, they're trying to convince you to put your mind into a power greater than yourself. That, you know, it talks about the electrons and everything and all that. So it wasn't really, I didn't need to be convinced about that, but I could see this is to help everybody. Because they're writing, and we're going to say things in here that really are trying to help you. We don't want to insult you, and we don't want to make you feel, however, we're going to have to say them, you know, and it goes on and tells you that. So I'm reading this thing, and then you get to chapter 5. I mean, can you imagine what it says? Can you imagine what it says in chapter 5? You have been an asshole your whole life. You cause trouble and blame everybody, and then you try to act sorry for yourself, and you have to really straighten up right away. And I'm thinking, whoo, whoo, man, put that, I closed that book. I thought, oh, Jesus, Lord, I don't know. You know, because I'm really one of them drunks, and I get loaded at the drop of a hat, and I'm really nervous about this whole thing. And so I go back. I say, you better open and read the rest of it. So I went and read the rest of it, and I read the rest of the big book, and I closed it, and I was really concerned. I thought, I wonder if I'll be able to do this. I wonder if I'll be able to do this. I don't know, you know? And then I thought to myself, Donald, you gotta do it. You gotta do it. There's no other thing for you to do. So, you know, I plunged right in. You know, I plunged right in. I thought that's, now, I didn't mention any drugs. I wouldn't mention them at the Van Ness house. I thought, don't mention them. It's the alcoholic recovery house. So I said, don't say anything about that. And because I'm a drunk, you know, I really am a drunk all the way to the bone, you know, but I'm also a dope addict, you know, so, you know, I'm not saying nothing, and I'm in the house, don't say it. And Paul Farmer, who was the manager of the house, was gone, and he happened to come back and sit in a group with us, and he was sitting there, and we're going around the group, you know how everybody says their name, you know, boo, 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 and Patty Ochoa, and I'm alcoholic, I'm Kay Steele, I'm an alcoholic, you know, and he said, I'm Paul Farmer, and I'm an alcoholic and a junkie, and my head whipped around. I thought, oh, he's a junkie. Thank God. Well, he took me under his wing. He realized who I was, and he understood what I was doing, and they encouraged me. People were so kind. I can't tell you. People were really kind. I could see they were trying their best to be nice. They wanted me to be there. I'll never forget. I was at the Wednesday night meeting, a Los Feliz meeting, and I was sitting there. I didn't have no shoes. I was barefoot. I didn't have shoes for a few days, probably a couple of weeks. And I was so embarrassed not to have any shoes. Everybody had shoes on. And I'm sitting there, you know, pretty cool. They used to say, sit on your hands and all that stuff, because I used to feel like I was going to explode in meetings. I just feel like I'm just going to explode and throw one of these metal ashtrays. I say, don't explode, whatever you do. And this woman walked over, and she had on some cute little Mary Jane shoes and a cute full skirt, and she had a white blouse on, and her hair was done, and she walked over to me, and she said, hi, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll never forget that. Never forget that. That's how kind people were. I knew these people wanted me to stay sober, and I wanted to stay sober really bad, really bad. So I started working the steps, and I got, you know, I'm doing this thing, and I'm hearing at meetings a lot of that principle stuff, you know, principles before personalities, and we work these principles in all of our affairs, and I'm getting nervous, you know, because I have no idea what a principle is, you know, so I'm scared, because I think you don't get these principles, you're going to be in trouble. And so there's this woman named Henrine, and Henrine, she was like a big sister to me, too. She had 4 years at the time. And I said, Henrine, what are these principles they keep talking about? And she said, well, baby, this is how it goes. She said, don't look at it as working the steps. Look at it as applying the principle. And she said, in the first step, you get honesty to replace dishonesty. And she said, in the second step, you get faith to replace doubt. And then in the third step, she said, you get hope to replace hopelessness. And she said, in the fourth, fifth, and sixth, you get courage to replace fear. And then she said, in the seventh step, honey, you get humility to replace pride. And she said, in 8, 9, and 10, you get responsibility to replace irresponsibility. I understood that. I understood that. Then she said, in 11, you get patience to replace that anxiety. And in 12, you get love, charity, and this is service. And they impressed me with being a service right away. They gaffled me up right away, and I started going on H&I things when I was 2 months old. They got me at I know people have to wait till six or a year and everything. They didn't care back in those days. They just dragged your ass anywhere, you know? And so that's what I started doing. I started going to those things, and everything worked out okay, and I got a baby when I was 5 months sober, and then Paul gave me a car, and people helped me out by giving me pancake turners and sheets and things so I could move into my little place. And so I moved to my little place, and that's what I started doing, going to meetings all the time and doing all this stuff and having a lot of fun. We had dances and all those things. It turned out to be a really great thing. It turned out to be the best thing that ever happened to me. I got a whole bunch of babies, and then we went through that period of the 80s where your friends were dying. Everybody's dropping dead all around you. We're having a memorial service every few weeks, and all these kids, their sponsors were dying. And so I felt my responsibility was, since their sponsor was dying, I better be their sponsor. So I wound up with 30-something babies, you know. And so it wasn't that I was trying to get them. It was just I felt that was my responsibility to do that. And we got through that, and things have happened. I had cancer, got over that. You know, I've had, different things happened. My daddy died when I was about 10. And I remember being in the room with him when he was, you know, before he died. And he looked over at me in a dark room. He said, "Donald, I'm not worried about you." He said, "God has got you in his hands." I said, "Yes, daddy." And he died. Many years later, as I had been in AA for some time, you know, and I learned a few things by watching people. I watched Peter with his mother, and he was my sponsor, and I watched people with their mother, so I knew what to do as my mother got older. And so I was there, Johnny on the spot. My brother had died already. My brother was gay, too. He drank and crackhead himself to death, bless his heart. And my sister, she's no better, bless her heart, too. But at any rate, I'm there with my mother, and I'm taking care of my mother all the way. And I had a niece, Kim, who I love dearly. She was my right hand. She was right there. She said, "I love Grammy, Uncle Donald. Don't worry. We'll do this." And we did it. And so my mother told me she's ready to go. One day she said, "You know, Donald, I'm ready to go." I said, "Okay, Mother." She said, "I'm just waiting." I said, "All right." And I went over to bless her. You know, I touched her on her head. And she grabbed my hand. And she said, "This is my beloved son in whom I'm well pleased." This disgrace, this terrible work turned out to be the one standing there with my mother. You talk about proud, proud of AA, proud that I had made it this far. It has been a wonderful ride. This is, I tell everybody, it's the best thing that happened to me. You can't tell me nothing bad about Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the best thing that's happened to me. If you don't believe me, read page 132 and 133 of the big book. It says, "We have been speaking to you of serious, sometimes tragic thing, but we aren't a glum lot. If newcomers could see no fun in our existence, they wouldn't want." I wouldn't either. Everybody's walking around, you know. So we have fun around here. But the next thing says, "We are sure God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free." I vote for that. Thank you very much.